through this text, he said, we have never been in a position where the decisions we make will have life or death impact. All of us gasped since the United States last week vetoed a resolution that would have stopped the killing in Gaza. This is where politicians and our governments are so disconnected from the demands and realities of ordinary people.
Asad Rehman, we want to thank you for being with us. Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson from the Climate Justice Coalition, speaking to us from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Coming up, as the UN General Assembly votes overwhelmingly for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, we bring you an exclusive. We'll speak with a Palestinian UN diplomat whose recent remarks in Geneva on Israel went viral. Stay with us. For a Dying Ocean by Small Island Big Song featuring Putad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The United Nations General Assembly has voted overwhelmingly for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. In Tuesday's vote, 153 nations approved the resolution, 23 abstained, just 10, including the U.S. and Israel, voted no. Though non-binding, the UN vote is another indication of the mounting isolation of the United States as it continues to support Israel's assault, which has killed over 18,000 Palestinians in a little over 2 months. The vote came just days after the United States vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, President Biden's delivered his sharpest criticism yet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. During a donor event in Washington, D.C., Biden criticized what he called Israel's, quote, indiscriminate bombing of Gaza. In a moment, we'll be joined by the Palestinian UN diplomat Nada Tarbush. But first, let's turn to a speech she gave in November at the UN in Geneva. It went viral.
Israel said something that should make all of you shudder. It effectively said, I can kill any and every person in Gaza. The 2.3 million people in Gaza are either terrorists or terrorist sympathizers or human shields and are therefore legitimate targets. Every person, according to Israel, falls into one of these three categories: a child, a journalist, a doctor, a UN staff, a newborn baby in an incubator. And so, according to Israel, it can kill them and then have the audacity to come to this room and tell the world with a straight face, we are acting in accordance with international law. The death of each of the over 11,350 people killed over the past month, be it children, journalists, UN staff, the sick, the elderly, according to Israel, was justified. Think about that for a moment and let it give you pause. Anyone espousing this warped logic has no shred of humanity, no sense of morality, and no knowledge of legality. But guess what? Your carpet explanation for carpet bombing will not fly. People are not fools. The people in this room are seasoned diplomats who are well-read, have a knowledge of history, and many of whom have seen your government make the same arguments during your 6 previous military aggressions on Gaza in the past 15 years. They have seen you resort to collective punishment, targeting of Palestinian children, journalists, medical staff, aid workers before. They have seen you forcibly transfer our communities, colonize our lands, demolish our homes, and evict families from their own properties since the 7th of October and for the 75 years that preceded it.
That was Palestinian UN diplomat Nada Tarbush speaking November 17th, almost a month ago. At the time, the death toll in Gaza from Israel's assault was about 11,000. Today, it's over 18,600. Nada Tarbush joins us now in an exclusive interview from Geneva, where she serves as counselor to the permanent observer mission of the State of Palestine to the United Nations in Geneva. I'm wondering, Nada Tarbush, if you can start off by responding to the UNGA, the UN General Assembly's overwhelming call, even if it is symbolic, for a Gaza ceasefire in response to the U.S. vetoing in the UN Security Council on Friday, the ceasefire call, at the same time that it looks like President Biden is intensifying his criticism of Netanyahu and the Israeli bombardment, criticizing indiscriminate bombing. If you can just take that on.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for having me, Amy. So with regard to the UNGA vote, what I'd like to first say is to put it in context for the audience. This resolution was brought to the General Assembly following the United States' veto on a resolution at the Security Council last Friday, which had called for an immediate ceasefire. And so states invoked tools that are available in the United Nations to, whenever the Security Council is deadlocked, to take the discussion to the General Assembly and on a matter of international peace and security. So this is what happened. And the vote was unsurprisingly, overwhelmingly for an immediate ceasefire. Now, the significance of this vote was that not only is it showing that the support that Israel had from many Western states, especially for its military assault on Gaza, is eroding. And even staunch supporters of Israel, like Australia and like Canada, are now saying we need a ceasefire. And so what this shows is that Israel is isolated, the United States is isolated. The General Assembly, which is the world's parliament and which is the most democratic organ in the United Nations, has said we overwhelmingly want an immediate ceasefire. Now, at the same time, and this is where sometimes you feel there's a parallel reality, you hear the United States voting against that, you see the United States voting against that resolution, and at the same time, words from the Biden administration about Israeli indiscriminate bombing. So my comment on that would be that we believe in actions and not words when it comes to the U.S. government. I have heard words in the U.N. that anyone would have thought were a good thing for the Americans to say, like, we care about Palestinian civilians, but this will not fly as long as we see the United States sending military aid, billions of dollars in military aid, using Americans' taxpayer money, which it could have used on other things like homelessness and healthcare, and sending that aid to help Israel commit a genocide. So I'm not convinced that the Biden administration has changed course. It is still voting against a ceasefire, vetoing Security Council resolutions, sending aid, and giving Israel all the diplomatic and political cover that it needs.
And Nada Tarbush, I wanted to ask you, before October 7th, both Israel and the United States were comfortably believed that the issue of Palestine had been forgotten by the rest of the world. I'm wondering your sense of how the world has rallied in the recent 2 months in support of the Palestinian cause?
I would say that the world has never forgotten Palestine, unless by the world we mean the powerful militarized states like the United States and other European states or other states from the global north, let's say. The international community has year after year called for a solution, called for an end to occupation, for an end to apartheid, an end to the settlement colonization project that we see in the West Bank. And so it is only a handful of powerful states that have been trying to get Palestine off the agenda and blocking any avenue to push for the rights of the Palestinian people under international law.
Could you talk as well about your own family history as it relates to Palestine? Your family fled in 1948, because in your powerful speech, you also talked about how relations between Jews and Palestinians were before the creation of Israel.
Yes, absolutely. My family are refugees from 1948. My father was from a village near Jerusalem, which is one of the more than 450 villages that were completely destroyed during the Nakba, which is the catastrophic events that led to mass ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and to the most protracted refugee crisis in the world. And my mother also is from a city that became part of Israel after 1948. The Palestine's history is one of diversity. It is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious land historically, which has hosted and welcomed all faiths, which has welcomed people of various ethnicities. It has always been a culturally diverse mosaic. And so this is why it is not surprising to me that many people don't see that this land can be transformed into an ethnocracy, into a state which is only for one people. And you have seen, even in the early days of Zionism, you had many Jewish intellectuals like Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, Sigmund Freud, and others who were against the idea of an exclusively Jewish state in the historical land of Palestine. They saw that that would cause issues like ethnic cleansing, like not respecting and indeed violating the rights of the indigenous inhabitants.
In your speech that you gave at the UN in Geneva, you referred to these remarks in March by Israel's far-right West Bank settler finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich.
There is no such thing as a Palestinian. There is no such thing as a Palestinian people. Do you know who is Palestinian? I am Palestinian.
So that is the finance minister, part of Netanyahu's government, Smotrich, saying there's no such thing as a Palestinian. And if for people, in case you had any trouble hearing this, I am a Palestinian, he said. I was wondering if you can respond.
Yes, I can. This is, again, not a surprising narrative. It is a narrative that we have been hearing for decades, which is that Israel does not want a Palestinian state. Golda Meir, a former Israeli prime minister, said that there is no such thing as a Palestinian people. Palestinians have been dehumanized since the creation of Israel and even before. And, you know, in order to try and justify this settler colonial project. And there was the myth of a land without a people for a people without a land. But there were people on this land, and they are the Palestinian people. And so for us to hear these kind of racist and colonialist slogans, is consistent with what Israel has been doing in terms of action throughout these years, which is to try and get rid of the maximum of Palestinian inhabitants from Palestine, from the West Bank, from Gaza, and to try and replace them with Israeli settlers. And so, you know, they're just saying explicitly what they have been doing. And I think that in Gaza now, what we are seeing is the continuation of this policy of mass ethnic cleansing, of forced displacement, of trying to get rid of the Palestinian population in order to take over the land.
You also know, you also note in your speech in September that Netanyahu held up a map on what he called the new Middle East that did not show Palestine during his speech, the United Nations General Assembly. It did not show the West Bank, East Jerusalem or Gaza. Explain what he's putting forward. And then President Biden now saying to this group of donors that he's criticizing Netanyahu, saying that he is doing this in Gaza because he doesn't want a Palestinian, a two-state solution.
Indeed, yes. So, again, this is not the first time that the Israelis have shown maps which completely delete the West Bank and Gaza and incorporate them into Israel and call them Israel. I mean, this has been done consistently. Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, as West Jerusalem and East Jerusalem were annexed. There are annexationist policies happening in the West Bank with the construction of settlements and the wall and the whole settler colonial infrastructure. And in Gaza, this is a similar project is underway. And Gaza and the West Bank have been occupied for 56 years. Palestinian dispossession has taken place for 75 years. It is an ongoing Nakba. It is a continuation of mass ethnic cleansing and annexationist policies. Now, the problem with them formally annexing these lands is that they would have to give the right to vote to the Palestinians, whose land they would be annexing. So instead, they try to get rid of the Palestinians before annexing the land. But the plan has been clear, and it is a plan to take over what remains of Palestine, which is very little. What remains of historic Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza constitute 22% of historic Palestine. With the settlements, this has reduced dramatically, and they're trying to take over whatever little bits are left.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Nada Tarbush, counselor to the Permanent Observer Mission of the State of Palestine to the United Nations in Geneva. This is her first broadcast interview since the video went viral of her UN address on Israel's bombardment of Gaza that she gave in Geneva. Coming up, we'll speak with Texas Congressmember Greg Kassar as President Biden appears to be caving to Republican demands for hardline border measures in exchange for funding for the war in Ukraine and beyond. Back in 20 seconds. Teardrops by Therese Sleiman and Yazim Ibrahim. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how President Biden appears to be caving to Republican demands for hardline border measures in exchange for funding for the war in Ukraine that also include a new crackdown on asylum seekers and immigrants nationwide. This is CBS reporter Camilo Montoya Galvez.
These changes include a new authority that would allow border agents to summarily expel migrants back to Mexico or their home countries, no questions asked, without an asylum screening, very similar to the Title 42 pandemic policy that ended in May. They have also proposed mandatory detention for the migrants who would be allowed to make a case for asylum. And finally, they would be open to a nationwide expansion of something called expedited removal, which is a fast-tracked deportation process that is currently limited to the border region.
As negotiations on Biden's emergency funding requests continue, we're joined from the Cannon Rotunda on Capitol Hill by Democratic Congressmember Greg Kassar of Texas. Our co-host Juan Gonzalez just joined Congressman Kassar for a congressional briefing Tuesday on U.S. Latin America policy. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Congressmember Kassar, if you can first respond to what's being negotiated at this point. Progressive Democrats saying to President Biden, you not only have to negotiate with the Republicans, you have to negotiate with us, which includes you, Congressmember Kassar.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks so much for having me on. And it is a really scary time here on Capitol Hill, where Republicans in the Senate are asking Democrats to cave in and hand them some of the worst changes to our immigration system in decades. Republicans and Democrats alike have both said that they support continued assistance to Ukraine, but the Republicans have held that hostage and have said, first, you've got to throw immigrant families under the bus. And like you've described, this would mean actually closing legal pathways for migration here and accelerating the deportation and separation of immigrant families. And so in the mainstream media, this is often being reported as, well, are they going to trade border security for Ukraine money? But this has nothing to do with changing or improving a situation at the border. What the Republicans are demanding is making it less easy to legally migrate and therefore fuel more irregular migration. What they're talking about is punishing families that are already in our cities and communities, dismantling the asylum system that we established after the enormous errors we made after World War II, turning refugees away. It is sick. And so what we're asking is for the Biden administration to stop encouraging these talks, asking Leader Schumer to just step in and say, if we want to debate Ukraine, we should debate Ukraine, but we shouldn't start throwing immigrant families under the bus. Next thing, they may ask for an abortion ban nationwide in exchange for something. Are they going to be asking for a ban on gay marriage next time? We just can't have Democrats doing the Republicans' dirty work here.
And Congressman, as we discussed at the briefing yesterday, the United States has spent over $330 billion the past 20 years on agencies that do border enforcement, and yet we have record numbers of people attempting to cross the border. What can be done to get Congress to finally address the issue of a much more comprehensive reform of our immigration system?
We have to actually want to improve the system for folks in the United States and for people migrating here. Unfortunately, the right wing wants to keep the system as broken as possible so that they can then complain about it. It's the classic case of the arsonists trying to blame the firefighters for the flames. And so in this case, Republican policy, and frankly, even some conservative and neoliberal Democratic policy, has only fueled greater challenges. Those policies are things like sanctions, imposing harsh sanctions in Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, then forcing people who are starving in part because of our policies to migrate and then complaining about it. Instead, we should make sure that people, if they want to be able to stay at home, stay in their home countries, that they can, and then open up legal pathways for migration. Instead, the Republican proposals we're dealing with, it actually, what they mostly would help is cartel profits, because what they want to do is close legal pathways for migration, force people that we are helping starve, have to move, oftentimes have to pay criminal organizations, and then the Republicans get to complain about it. It is a toxic brew that Democrats shouldn't be playing into. Instead, we should say, let's open up more legal pathways for people to migrate here. Let's open up the ability for folks to ask for parole and get on a plane and apply and come here and get a work permit quickly. That would relieve a lot of what you're seeing on the TV, Fox TV cameras on the border, and actually make things better for people in Latin America and in the United States. but instead we insist on punishing Latin America, pushing people out of their home countries, and then not opening up legal pathways for them to migrate.
Juan, I wanted to put this question to you. You and Congressmember Greg Kassar were part of a panel yesterday called 200 Years is Enough, Moving Past the Monroe Doctrine Toward a New Era in U.S.-Latin American Relations. Can you put this current push at this moment, right, because the House Speaker says they're going to go home at the end of the week if they don't get their way on border. Biden is desperate to get money for Ukraine. And so we don't know at this point what's going to happen. McConnell says there's no way they can do this before Christmas. But put this in that broader 200-year context. I mean, you wrote that incredible book that's now a textbook in so many college classes called Harvest of Empire. Talk about how this fits in with the Monroe Doctrine and what that was.
Well, yes. Well, the Monroe Doctrine for 200 years has been the basic policy that the United States has pursued in the entire Western Hemisphere, but especially toward Latin America, telling European and other colonial powers, you stay out of the Western Hemisphere. This is our backyard, in essence. And it's been used repeatedly by U.S. presidents and Congresses to invade countries in Latin America, to foment clandestine or covert operations, to remove leaders that weren't sufficiently obedient to the United States. And I think it's never really been repealed or refuted by U.S. leaders. I mean, there was a small attempt by John Kerry during the Obama administration to claim it was over, but President Trump backtracked on that and went back to the bullying of the United States and Latin America. And I'm wondering, Congressman Kassar, your sense of the prospects for being able to have a new policy for Latin America in the future.
It's time for us to leave that 200-year Monroe Doctrine legacy behind us. And I think a small number of progressives who start to open up a window to a new relationship in Latin America are going to carve the path forward here. Because instead of spending our limited resources on things you've covered, Juan, overthrowing the government in Guatemala in the 50s, the invasion of Cuba, arming Contra rebels in Nicaragua, currently continuing to starve instead of feed people in places like Cuba and Venezuela, instead of engaging in that honestly doesn't help in Latin America and doesn't help us here, we can create a new partnership. I was just in Chile for nearly the anniversary of us helping overthrow the Chilean government of Allende back in the day. And part of the reason we did that is because we wanted to protect United States and Chilean elites in the copper industry. That was disastrous. So many people died. It helped no one. But instead, finally, we could have a conversation about how do we support democracy and support one another in rising authoritarianism? How, as we head towards a renewable and climate more resilient future, they have instead the resources for us to create batteries. How do we create those together and make sure working class people in Chile and the United States benefit, not just big corporations? There is a real ability for us to work with Latin America to tackle the climate crisis, beat back authoritarianism, address migration. That would actually benefit our constituents and our communities. And I think folks would get reelected on that kind of work in Latin America rather than continued invasions.
And we just have 10 seconds. Do you think President Biden hears you? What do you think's going to happen? Your prediction, Congressman?
What I can tell you for sure is that you're going to see increased pressure coming from Hispanic, Black, and Asian members of Congress, progressive members of Congress. You're going to see us hosting press conferences, delivering letters, and saying we're going to be a no vote on this whole package.
Congressmember Greg Kassar, Democrat from Texas, will also link to Tuesday's congressional briefing, 200 Years is Enough, Moving Past the Monroe Doctrine Toward a New Era in U.S.-Latin American Relations. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcroft, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Sanji Lopez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. We hope you have a joyful Hanukkah and a Happy New Year.
susun rahe ho CJSF 90.1 FM. Jo ki Burnaby, British Columbia vich sthit hai.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.